Tricksterism, yes, it has a super old history, but it like acquires this special function in the Soviet setting as a kind of alternative framing of reality, where as a trickster, you can reframe maybe what would otherwise be merely survival as like a fun adventure. And your tricks become an artistic performance of freedom.
The novel The Little Golden Calf is the story of Ostap Bender, a con artist trying to become a millionaire in 1920s Soviet Russia, a time when millionaires weren't supposed to exist. Little read in the rest of the world, the book is a classic in Russia. It's taught in schools, there's multiple movie and TV adaptations, statues of the main characters can be found in towns across the country, and lines from the book have made their way into common usage. Faced with anything that's not all it was cracked up to be, a Russian might say, no, this is not Rio de Janeiro. Dodgy enterprises can be labelled horns and hoods, a group of suspected con artists may be called the children of Lieutenant Schmidt. On this episode of the podcast, I talk to Maya Vinokur from the Department of Russia and Slavic Studies at NYU about the book, its history, and what it can tell us about Putin, Trump, and 21st century satire. If you enjoy the podcast, why not support me on Patreon? There's a link in the show notes. Or you can just leave a review, or even easier, tell your friends about the podcast. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson, and this is Scammapalooza. When I told people that I wanted to talk about The Little Golden Calf, most people that I talked to about it said, what's The Little Golden Calf? And then I said, it's a Soviet era satire of Russian life. And I got a lot of eye rolling at that suggestion because I think people thought that I was being a bit pretentious. When you want to talk about something like a book like The Little Golden Calf with your friends or people who don't necessarily share your love for Russian literature without sounding pretentious.
No, well, you know, I've strategically removed everyone from my life who could pretend who wouldn't be like a fellow extreme nerd. Also, I was born in Moscow and my parents and I immigrated to the States and I was 4. So for me, both the Little Golden Calf and its predecessor novel, The 12 Chairs, they're sort of like part of just normal conversation growing up. The copy of the books that I read belonged to my grandmother. And these were like very old books that maybe they were from the 50s or the 60s. I can't remember. It was an old edition. And so it was always kind of on the shelf. And the novels have never been something apart from my everyday experience. And then because I either am talking about the novels to people who already know what they are, or I'm sort of like subtweeting them in conversation because as you wrote to me, so many phrases from the novels are just part of regular ass conversation that people have. So it's not a huge stretch to refer to them. And then, of course, when I use them, there's a whole apparatus for doing that.
I guess it's almost like The Simpsons in that way, in that people are constantly quoting it, and it's just part of the vernacular. And it's almost seems to have reached a point that there are people That's who right. use phrases and quotes from the book that may not necessarily know that they're from the book.
I think that's totally possible. I don't have a good sense of like how much contemporary Russians or like I don't know like the youth of contemporary Russia, how much they have read or not read both of the books, but at least like again in my family, in my household, It was just like unmarked references, this exactly the same way that people talk about The Simpsons or, at least in my peer group, The Big Lebowski, where like every other line potentially in a conversation is just like a quote, but you don't say where it comes from. You sort of assume that your interlocutors know, and then it's a kind of shibboleth and a way of forming social bonds.
And that seems to be a big reason why the book is so beloved in Russia, is because of that. Particularly for people who grew up at that time, that they had that shared experience and they know that there's something very specific about the time and place that the book is talking about.
Yeah, I think it's actually really interesting that like by now, in order to understand the specifics of the satire that Ivan Petrov were creating, you basically need like an elaborate manual, and such a thing exists. It's like a roadmap to each of the novels by two literary scholars, where like multiple times per page, they're like, okay, well, this refers to this specific like political grouping, you know, from 1925, like this refers to this specific like product that was available. And you, so somehow the novel transcends its, you know, the specificity of its time and place in order to be completely immortal and usable in a lot of different contexts. And that's like, that's kind of what I ended up arguing in my article from many years ago. Basically, you can, like, that's sort of a thing about satire, is that it's available to anyone for different purposes. You can use it subversively or you can use it non-subversively.
So English language examples might be Gulliver's Travels, where Swift is making all sorts of references to modern politics that we today just don't get. And so we enjoy the story about little people and giants, or even Alice in Wonderland, yeah, which isn't technically satire, but still has fun with the news of the day. So you can kind of enjoy it on all those levels.
Absolutely. And I think like some things that, you know, some things that end up looking just like wacky to the contemporary reader or just like inexplicable, they're, Edfin Petrov are incredibly precise, and they're incredibly well embedded in their context. They were journalists, and they, you know, they worked in various jobs before they like ended up forming this literary duo. And they're like very well attuned to the political and social climate, which is like a very turbulent and varied one. So they're like some of the stuff that seems really like wacky or arbitrary in the books is actually highly tethered to their time. And I don't know how you experience that as a non-specialist reader, like just as a casual reader, like what did you get out of the book that was enjoyable?
To be honest, to me, it was a lot of it was a sense of almost like when you're a child and you watch something which is aimed at adults and you know that it's funny, but you're not 100% sure why. Mm-hmm. I mean, again, going back to The Simpsons, like most things do, you watch The Simpsons and, you know, I watch it with my kids and they chuckle away at jokes and I know they don't fully understand them, but they enjoy the language and they enjoy the reference and they enjoy the fact that there is a joke being made. For me, I think it both confirmed some of the stereotypes of Soviet Russia, which is the kind of the poverty that existed, and also the bureaucracy, which is kind of the stereotypes that come to mind, that everything has to be stamped 72 times and you have to have lots of documentation to prove things are, and at the same time everyone is very, very proud and nationalistic at the same time as suffering through these various hardships. And so it confirmed those stereotypes a little bit, but then for me added a whole lot of interesting texture in terms of the characters and the specificity. My favorite line, and I think this is one that has become a turn of phrase, is the schnitzel inventory.
Yeah, like the store is closed in order to like to inventory the schnitzels.
Yeah, we're gonna be closed today because we need to count how many schnitzels. Yeah. How do you use it as a turn of phrase? Like, how do you
literally, I have said that probably this week in some way. You use it when something is closed for like a dumb reason, like a clearly dumb and irrational reason. Like you go to the store and it's like on a lunch break, but you're there at 3 p.m. So you're like, what, why is this closed? If there's some like dumb sign. One time I can't remember, you know, this is like very characteristic of the time we live in. Like I either saw this on the internet or I saw it in real life, but it was like, you know, the, it was like a paper, like a printout that was taped to a garbage chute in an apartment building. That was like, you know, garbage disposal closed for upgrade. It's like, you know, you can't like dispose of your trash from your apartment, but like this thing is claiming that you're experiencing an upgrade. And like, that's the setting where I would say like, oh, it's closed to inventory the schnitzels. Like it's closed for no reason. I should say the novels and like the specific language that they use and just like the whole kind of like culture of humor that they point to is maybe it's really characteristic of Odessa in Ukraine, which is where both of the authors came from. Even though this is like another interesting thing about the novel is that, like, even though, you know, it's associated with Soviet satire and it's like appropriated into the Russian cultural canon of the 20th century, it's like it's actually comes from like a super, I guess, culturally diverse, not ethnically Russian environment, namely Odessa.
Yeah, I mean, I think as an outsider, there's always that tendency to talk about Russia and Russians, and to turn them into a monoculture. I guess though, I mean, when you talk about the using the phrase "it's closed for the schnitzel inventory" today, it does also show that the book is really exploring fairly universal themes. Doesn't matter whether you're
in Soviet Russia or capitalist
America. You obviously talked about both books, and I guess we should explain that there is The 12 Chairs, which is the first book, which is about the it's about the hunt for treasure that is hidden in a chair.
Yeah, I mean, they are substantively related, because Astap, who, by the way, like, Astap's name already points to the fact that he's not Russian, you know, in a way, right? Like, Astap is a Ukrainian name, and then Bender is ambiguous, it's like possibly Jewish, it's like not clear, but he is present in both novels, and so they're united by his presence. And also the second novel kind of, should I do spoilers?
Oh yeah, I think so. Let's do spoilers here. It is one of those books where I feel like the story is not quite as important as the characters and the episodic events.
It's a picaresque, right? So it's an episodic narrative where there are like adventures, and they sort of amount to something, but the point is not the plot, even though it's also structured as like a treasure hunt story, right? Like, you have to basically reassemble the set of 12 chairs in the first novel in order to figure out which of them has the like secret diamonds in it. And Astap dies at the end, or he appears to die at the end of the first novel, and then he's symbolically resurrected in the beginning of the second, and then he's like the hero of the second as well. So I do think of them as belonging to the same narrative.
Yeah.
Narrative split into.
I think for me, because of my love of con artists and scams, he's my favorite character from the first book. And that's why I love the second book so much. It is very much like, hey, remember that book you enjoyed? Well, here's another one. And it's just, you know, it focuses on your favorite character doing the thing that you enjoyed him doing the most in the first book. So let's talk about Petrov and Ilf. You said they had a lot of jobs before they wrote these books. What were they doing beforehand?
Ilf was the son, I believe, of a bank clerk. Also, both of them were writing under pseudonyms, right? Ilf had a much more traditionally Jewish, both first and last name, although I think in his family he was called Ilya. And then Petrov was the younger brother of Valentin Kataev, who was a famous Soviet writer in his own right, and I think gave them the idea for the 12 chairs. Like, already, you know, even the first novel had like a certain kind of like pedigree and positioning. But yeah, they, at the time when they began working on the first book, they were both writers for the newspaper Gudok, the train whistle. They both had done like some writing before that.
And I understand that Petrov was a government inspector or a police investigator.
Yeah, I think he briefly worked in that capacity, but I don't, and I think that was before writing the novels. But yeah, like by the time they were writing the novels, they were like quite professionalized as writers, and then they like went on. They actually went on to travel to America and write a travelogue/critique of capitalism called One Storied America, and then they both. Died pretty young. I think Ilf died shortly on, like, after returning to the Soviet Union after their like American sojourn of tuberculosis. And then Petrov died, I think, in 1942. So they both, that sort of like adds to their lore. Also, apparently Petrov was never as, he never quite like recaptured the magic that was contained in their duo. So like they needed each other to like form this sort of like two-headed writer.
What was it like being a writer in, you know, the late 1920s and early 30s? Because that's the early years of the Soviet regime. How did writers, particularly satirical writers, how did they operate without getting in trouble?
The thing is, like, part of the reason that I mention the 12 chairs and like it makes, why it makes sense to talk about it in conjunction with the Golden Calf, is because really the two moments in which, like, the respective moments in which those novels were written are really different moments in Soviet history. I think Soviet history, like any other history, only looks monolithic from a great distance. But like when you look closely, there are distinct periods that are continuous with each other, but also differ from each other. So like 1927 is, you know, toward the tail end of the new economic policy, which is like a strategic retreat from a much more overtly horrible policy of war communism that was the like rule of the day during the Soviet Civil War. So like the 1920s are this time when like limited private enterprise is allowed. It's like slightly more relaxed, although it's a time of intense debates about what should constitute Soviet culture and what should constitute Soviet literature. So to be a writer in the 1920s specifically, like roughly before 1928, when Stalin has banished Trotsky, he has completed his consolidation of power. He's like pivoting into the first five-year plan. New economic policy is over, right? Like there's sort of like an important rift that separates even the end of the 20s and the early 30s when the Little Golden Calf comes out from the earlier period. So to be a satirist in the 1920s was to be part of a super diverse and experimental conjunction of like different cultural threads that were all competing with each other. Whereas to be writing in 1931 means that you were like, you know, the culture is much more consolidated and it's like moving in the direction of socialist realism, which is, you know, declared the privileged, really the only kind of appropriate or orthodox Soviet aesthetic in 1904. But already like in 1932, 31, like it's already sort of like moving that direction, cultural consolidation and that kind of thing. And like maybe this is like part of what I wrote about in my article about these novels. There was a lot of discussion about, you know, what should Soviet culture look like? What kinds of art are appropriate for Soviet people to consume in order to come, ideologically appropriately informed? And also like appropriately artistically developed, right? The Soviet power, even from the beginning, had a kind of like pedagogical bent where it was all about like teaching you how to be an appropriate Soviet citizen. So like, should the Soviet person laugh? If so, how? So, like, to be a satirist in the 20s was kind of to like, you know, there were a lot of people who were like, no, you know, laughter is inappropriate during the reconstructive period. So-called, you know, after the revolution, like we have way more important shit to do. Like we shouldn't waste our time like lollygagging and whatever. And then there were people who were like, no, actually satire is like an extremely kind of Soviet thing to do because it's a weapon on the cultural front, right? Like everything is conceived in terms of war metaphors. It's like a really like stabby weapon that you can use to, you know, like castrate ideological enemies or whatever. And then like, as we move toward cultural consolidation and the creation of socialist realism, then like there start to be rules about like how to depict X, you know, we start to develop canons, you know, what novels should be used as examples for Soviet writers and so on.
Two weeks ago, I launched my first Patreon for this very podcast, and I was overwhelmed how many people were willing to reach into their pockets to contribute a few dollars to support the work I do here on Scammapalooza. This is a one-person operation. It's just me interviewing, promoting, editing, producing the whole lot. And so any support you can give is greatly appreciated. There's a link down below if you'd like to join the Patreon family and help keep Scammapalooza running. You refer to it as a picaresque, and in the sense of it is a trickster, or I've heard him described as a creative idiot, which I think is a great phrase, and often, you know, obviously a con artist. What is the significance of having a trickster or a con artist main character in Soviet fiction?
I mean, this is something that people, as you can imagine, like people write a great deal about, and so I'm going to refer to my colleague Mark Lipovetsky, who has actually written a book on the subject of the Soviet trickster. And the central, idea of that book, which itself like draws on a ton of different sources, is that basically in the Soviet context, tricksterism becomes a way to deal with one's vulnerable position in a setting like the Soviet one. The like delicious nugget that I usually take from it is that tricksterism is this kind of, yes, it has a super old history, but it like acquires this special function in the Soviet setting as a kind of alternative framing of reality, where as a trickster, right, you can reframe maybe what would otherwise be merely survival as like a fun adventure. And your tricks become an artistic performance of freedom. So you're kind of like thumbing your nose at authority while maintaining plausible deniability. That's like the number one rule of every troll is like maintain plausible deniability. And it also is situational in a way, right? Like the trickster disposes of different identities that work in different settings. So like you see, like Astap is, you know, the, however this term is translated, like the smooth operator, the great combinator or like whatever, right? Because so he's able to adapt to his circumstances and then turn every hardship into a kind of, yeah, like a performance of freedom, where it's not just that he cons people, right? Like he does it in a way that is fundamentally kind of artistic. And that's why it's also, you know, that's like something that makes him so appealing is like, he's not just like some asshole. Like he has a very particular code. You know, he's nice to children. He doesn't murder anyone. He actually becomes the victim of an attempted murder himself. And everything is done kind of like for the love of the game, as well as for, so he has this like artistic quality that makes him more than just a grifter. And that's, you know, that's Soviet tricksterism in a way. And of course, like the other thing about tricksterism is that it's a fundamentally unstable identity. So I was saying at the beginning of this conversation that you can be like my hypothesis about why these novels have endured has to do with the fact that they are, yes, like they satirize Soviet life and they poke fun at like certain aspects of Soviet reality, but they're fundamentally simpatico with the aims of the Soviet project. And even Astap eventually gets his comeuppance because like can't really become a millionaire. He's, you know, he cannot become like the white pants wearing cool dude in Rio de Janeiro. He sort of like slips on the ice of Soviet reality. He experiences defeat. So he is ultimately not a successful con man, although because it's like a light comic novel in a way, they rescue him from, you know, he doesn't completely get destroyed.
In the case of, I was just thinking, both Ostap and Petrov and Ilf, the target is never the Soviet regime itself or the Soviet way of life, but rather low-level bureaucrats and small-time operators. And like in all good con artist stories, people who you kind of think deserve it. And in fact, in the end of the book, he sets his sights too high and decides to become a millionaire, which is not something you should be aiming to be in Soviet Russia. And so is punished, as you said, for it. Originally, he did get away with it, right? In the original version of the book, he did escape with the money.
Yeah, I think so. Like, if I recall correctly, it's been like a long time since I've looked at different versions. I think they thought about allowing him to like escape and attain the ideal of living in Rio de Janeiro. But yeah, like it just doesn't work. For a number of reasons to like let him do it, right? He has to be, the system foils him, and there's like a really telling moment where he is on the train and he encounters these like model Soviet young people and they all get along, but then he realizes that he reveals that he's a millionaire. They're all they're disenchanted with him immediately and they don't understand. It's like it's a complete rupture, right? Like the triumph of the con man is just not recognized in this new society. Like the new generation does not need millions and millions of rubles because they have cool lives anyway. And so Astap like actually actively feels himself becoming outdated. So there's something about both novels that's like con men and grifters are a thing of the past. This is, by the way, a very big theme in 1920s era Soviet cultural discourse. Like, you know, how do we actually, you know, conclude the previous chapter of history and begin everything completely anew when many of the people currently alive, like grew up in the old regime and have retained various like harmful ideological and personal habits. And that's why like a lot of Ostap's companions in both novels are like old dudes, old men who come from settings where that no longer exist. You know, like Kislevod Abyanov in The 12 Chairs, where like his entire way of being in the world is it just like has stopped existing. Like there's no, they're like a way for him to wear the same clothes, say the same words. He's a walking anachronism. And Ostap is constantly mocking him, but in a way they belong together because Ostap too belongs to the old world in the second novel. Jews in Odessa, you know, like at the beginning of the 20th century. Is that what you're thinking about? Like the old man who's like pathetically chasing after geese the whole time?
You see that in the opening of The Little Golden Calf with the children of Lieutenant Schmidt, where the con artists are all pretending to be the children of the war hero Schmidt in order to get money. And there's so many of them that they essentially form a union of con artists and divvy up the area so that you don't have two children of Lieutenant Schmidt showing up. And then one of the children, the son of Lieutenant Schmidt, breaks the rules. He's the third son of Lieutenant Schmidt to show up and try and scam the same government official on the same day. And the first two just get away with it. And then the third one is tossed out. You know, sure, you can be a grifter, but you've got to be a modern, up-to-date grifter like us and follow the rules.
Yeah, you have to be a modern, up-to-date grifter. And in the end, like, even that won't help you because by the end, like I feel like Ostap's schemes are, they're often semi-successful, but they get, like, less and less successful as time goes on. In both novels, in both ending, he just miscalculates. And after, you know, in the first one, he more or less ends up dead because of it. And in the second one, it's clear that it's also a kind of death where he's, like, about to be caught by the border guards. And he's thinking to himself, this is another like super famous line. I'm going to have to like change my qualification.
Oh, is it that now I will have to become a building superintendent?
That's right. Which also like, this is a really double-edged joke because like on the one hand, he's saying like, I'm going to have to become a decent citizen and like get like a real job basically. On the other hand, it suggests that, you know, building superintendents are a bunch of crooks. And that's like clearly intentional, right? So like it all works in two ways. There's always, it's very trollish. It lulls and there's plausible deniability. You know, the two are somehow managed to combine and like exist together in this very like volatile complex.
You mentioned in your article that you see the book as a little bit of cultural catharsis that people are able to, I guess, work with and mourn things they may have lost or laugh at and appreciate things that aren't quite perfect about life now. Sometimes I guess we see satire as being a, you know, as a weapon, as something we can wield against people in power. But I get the feeling that with this book, it was sort of used by the Soviets as a way to say, yes, these are all things we can laugh at, roll our eyes and shake our heads at the, you know, the ridiculousness of life. But now that we've done that, we're going to move on and continue with this way of working.
The novels can function in a multitude of ways because they're great works of art, so they're alive and they can be deployed in like a variety of ways. But they simultaneously, at least to me, manage to be defenses of the Soviet order, imperfect and evolving as it may be. At the same time, Ostap is like a popular hero who is enjoyed by like, you know, ragtag band of dissidents in the late Soviet period, like precisely because he's constantly like giving the finger in a really appealing way to the entire Soviet order. This again is this double-edged nature of Soviet tricksterism. At the same time, it's hard to say whether they're intentional or not, but they function, my article is about how there are these references to trauma, you know, blink and you might miss them, but they're nonetheless important. And they point to the function of satire as a tool of self-discipline. I mentioned before, a lot of what the culture of the 1920s was about was figuring out who the new Soviet person was going to be and how that new Soviet person could be produced and like educated and formed. And so a lot of Soviet cultural production is explicitly pedagogical and kind of like disciplinary. It's like about cultivating the appropriate habits of mind to create citizens who are then going to build socialism and communism. And in a way, the 12 chairs and the little golden calf are kind of doing that. But at the same time, they're letting people like linger on traumatic moments. A lot of these characters who, I mean, I agree with you that like a lot of the characters are kind of like throwaway dumbasses that we're meant to laugh at, or like get their just desserts. And we're supposed, as readers, we're supposed to be like, yes, like it is correct that Poniatowski does not succeed in being the nth son of Lieutenant Schmidt. On the other hand, both Vorobyanin in the first novel and Poniatowski in the second are like, they're really, they're not throwaway characters. They have moments of genuine pathos, and Poniatowski's end is tragic. Like, I think genuinely tragic in a way that makes the picaresque kind of like grind to a halt. Like, it's very sad when he dies. And he's also much more pathetic than you might expect because he's old. So like, you have to think about like the idea of like the waste of human life and like the disposability of the human being in the Soviet context, right? And that isn't erased by the fact, you know, by all of these other factors that I mentioned. So, and it's, you know, it's always very hard to ascribe particular intentions to authors, but the effect is definitely there. Like, you laugh, but like you also sort of cry. So, you know, one of the things I write in the article is that Soviet satire is not supposed to be Gogol style laughter through tears. It's just supposed to be like healthy patriotic laughter or whatever, right? But like, you can't overcome, you know, centuries of beautiful tradition of, in fact, things being funny, like partly through also being sad at the same time.
You mentioned there is a line that goes through this kind of satire leading right up to today and Putin and the way in which he presents himself to the world. I saw it argued that he has, in a lot of his speaking, has adopted the satiric style of Stiob.
I was just going to mention Stiob. So Stiob is a particularly like late Soviet style of humor that, at least to me, has much in common with online trolling as we know it today. Like with satire, it's like it's clear who is the mocker and who is the mockee. With Stiob, it's like not totally clear. It's an incredibly like volatile form of humor where like the subject is themselves implicated potentially in the structures that they're mocking. There's often like, you know, the mask of troller's sensibility is often almost impenetrable to where like you don't like you kind of don't know necessarily whether the context is joking or serious. And there is often plausible deniability. That is, you can claim that like actually you're being completely serious and respectful, but actually what you're doing is you're like you're eating away at the foundation respect itself, right? And so I don't think that we should give Putin too much credit, but like we can observe certain behaviors that he does. And like, who knows if they're, you know, who knows if he's being a troll or whether these are like special KGB techniques of like destabilizing the discourse and destabilizing one's interlocutors. And he does this, for example, by strategically like swearing or we're using like crass language or making jokes that are like not appropriate to the occasion. I feel like he hasn't done this as much lately because he has to be like puffy war president. Yeah, but it used to be something he was like known for doing this for like being very serious one moment and then the next moment he's saying like drown them in the outhouse or whatever, like stupid shit.
Yeah. But often, as you point out, doing both at the same time. I've seen him being interviewed and he's talking about Donald Trump and he's making remarks about Trump that to me seem quite not at all controversial or extreme. I think he just said, oh, you know, yes, I, to be honest, felt like Trump went too far and I didn't think he was going to win the election. And there's raucous laughter from the, you know, the people in the room who know what he's really saying. And it's clear that there is multiple meanings going on, some of which I'm unaware of and don't fully understand, but I am not the intended audience for that sort of second level of messaging, that kind of dog whistle politics that's going on.
The dog whistles are for the like the local dog, right?
That's great. I like it.
but like one of my favorite moments of cross-cultural mistranslation was when Trump thought that Putin called him a talented person. Do you remember this? This is like extremely ancient.
Yeah.
But like actually the word that Putin used, I believe, was yarky, which can also mean like bright or flamboyant. I don't think that Putin meant it to be complimentary, nor do I think that he meant to explicitly insult Trump. Instead, he meant to take advantage of a situation where the word would be translated a million different ways. And then like through garbling in the channel, Trump receives the message that like Putin is a huge fan of his. And I think that's trolling, right? He's talking shit about Trump, but he's doing it in a way where if anyone scrutinizes his choice of words, they will not find fault. Yeah, like this, I think there is a direct line from 1920s era satire to like late Soviet stub to post-Soviet grifting and tricksterism to the present day configuration.
So you're saying that it made me think a lot of the way in which the sort of cable 24-hour cable news in America have slowly started to adopt the style of humor and the style of presentation of American satirical news programs, and that you see, you know, you have Fox News presenters talking like Jon Stewart or Stephen Colbert or Seth Meyers, and saying outrageous things in those kind of settings, but still being able to pass them off as news, to the point where some of them have had to argue in court. Oh no, it's just entertainment, not actually news. Is that the same sort of, I guess, repurposing of satire as ambiguous dog whistling?
I mean, in fact, this is a phenomenon that scholars have noticed. And in 2010, I think there's an article that came out that compared late Soviet stub to like Jon Stewart and Colbert and like their style of satire and humor. And then I think like that directly informs what you're talking about. So like, yeah, I feel like there's, you know, there's definitely grist for that mill. But also, I mean, how are you going to convey information to the public other than by clowning around in this day and age?
Speaking of clowns, and just to wrap up, have you seen the Little Golden Calf 12 Chairs prequel movie, Ostap the Beginning?
No, I haven't.
It's a Russian film. The translation in English is either Bender the Beginning or Bender Gold of the Empire. It's a 2021 film. I have not seen it, 2021,
wow.
And it basically tries to present, it's like a prequel to the books that essentially sets him up as an Indiana Jones type swashbuckling hero.
Oh man, that is like deeply satisfying cultural artifact. I will have to take a look at it, but I'm like literally just hearing about it now for the first time, so I have no opinions on it except that I'm looking at the release poster, and it is very Indiana Jonesy, yeah. I will say too. It's a sort of amalgamation of a lot of different cultural moments here. There's also there's like a hot air balloon. I see like the Eiffel Tower, a windmill, all the yum yums in one place.
Yes, it's like everything you would want. We should add like the 1968 film that's of the Little Golden Calf. That's the one that people seem to enjoy the most and is seen as the favorite. Is that right?
I don't know very much about the films, including the Mel Brooks adaptation, right? There's like an American, there's something about the humor of those novels that is distinct, it's like a distinctly Jewish sensibility. And I think that Mel Brooks is I think he like that caught his eye. Like it's definitely Jewish humor partly, right? Or Odessa humor, which is like heavily inflected with Yiddishisms.
He also loves his big cast and series of humorous set pieces as well, which you get in.
And plastic, yeah. Right? I think he like that caught his eye. I if I had to guess, right? Like he wants to sort of like capitalize on that same sort of like it's definitely Jewish humor partly, right? Or Odessa humor, which is like heavily inflected with you know, Yiddishisms and Jewish humor.
He also loves his big cast and series of humorous set pieces as well, which you get in.
And plastic, right?
So it sounds like there's no excuse not to dive into the world of the 12 Chairs or the Little Golden Calf, whether it's the books or the movies or even, I think, the TV series. Thank you so much for coming on Scammapalooza today. I've had a ball.